Om Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Srimad Bhagavatam, 7th Canto, Chapter 4, Hiranyakashipu terrorizes the universe. Text 8. Devo Jnana Shriya Jushtam Adyaste Smat Tripishtapam Mahendra Bhavanam Sakshan Nirmitam Vishvakarmana Trilokya Lakshayatanam Ajuva Shakilardhimat Devo Jnana Shriya Jushtam Adyaste Smat Tripishtapam Mahendra Bhavanam Sakshan Nirmitam Vishvakarmana Trilokya Lakshya Yatanam Ajuvasa Kilard Dimat Devo Dhyana Shriya Jushtam Adyaste Smat Tripishtapam Mahendra Bhavanam Sakshan Nirmitam Vishvakarmana Trilokya Lakshya Yatanam Ajuvasa Kilad Dimat Vaishnavis. Deva Ujjana of the famous God. Shriya by the opulences. Drushtam enriched. Adhyaste Sma remained in. Tripishtapam the higher planetary system where various demigods live. Mahendra Bhavanam, the palace of Indra, the king of heaven. Sakshat, directly. Nirmitam, constructed. Vishvakarmana, by the famous architect of the demigods. Vishvakarma. Trailokya, of all the three worlds. Lakshmi Ayatanam, the residence of the goddess of fortune. Ajuvasa, lived in. Akila Riddhi Mutt, possessing the opulence of the entire universe. Translation. Hiranyakashipu, who possessed all opulence, began residing in heaven with its famous Nandana garden, which is enjoyed by the demigods. In fact, he resided in the most opulent palace of Indra, the king of heaven. The palace had been directly constructed by the demigod architect Vishvakarma and was as beautifully made as if the goddess of fortune of the entire universe resided there. Purport. From this description, it appears that all the heavenly planets of the upper planetary system are thousands upon thousands of times more opulent than the lower planetary system in which we live. Vishvakarma, the famous heavenly architect, is known as the constructor of many wonderful buildings in the upper planets, where there are not only beautiful buildings, but also many opulent gardens and parks, which are described as Nandana Devojana, gardens quite fit to be enjoyed by the demigods. This description of the upper planetary system and its opulences is to be understood from authoritative scriptures like the Vedic literatures. Telescopes and the other imperfect instruments of scientists are inadequate for evaluating the upper planetary system, although such instruments are needed because the vision of the so-called scientists is imperfect. The instruments themselves are also imperfect. Therefore, the upper planets cannot be appraised by imperfect men using imperfect man-made instruments. Direct information received from the Vedic literature, however, is perfect. We therefore cannot accept the statement that there are no opulent residences on planets other than this Earth. Om Aganatirmadandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshur Militang Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadha Sivasadi Gaura Bhaktavrinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare Hare. Basically, in this purport, Srila Prabhupada is telling us, as Acharya, that we live in a low-class neighborhood. And it may take you a while to get over that, because to you, there are comforts and luxuries and enjoyment available on this planet. You'd never know unless someone gave you a perspective so you could see how everything fits in its particular place. Our attachment to low-class material enjoyment is because of ignorance, and the ignorance is the result of sinful activity. The sinful activity produces more ignorance, the ignorance produces more sinful activity, and in this way, we are caught in total forgetfulness of even a higher standard of material enjoyment. We become so attached to the devilish delights of this low-class neighborhood. When we hear the information in Srimad Bhagavatam, we can lift our perspective just a bit. And hearing about the heavenly planets does that. Hiranyakashipu has annexed all the properties, pleasure groves, entertainment places, and palaces of the demigods. He didn't do that by pious activity. He did that by his accumulated austerities and mystic powers in pursuit of total control and freedom from anyone's sanction. He was not going to make the mistake that Maharaj Vaina made, that you read about in the fourth canto, who, although seized all power in a particular place on earth, nevertheless, he left himself open to curses from the Brahmana sages, and they killed him with high-sounding words. So Hiranyakashipu understood there are very powerful mystic saints in the cosmos, like Bhrigu Muni. I've got to be careful that I don't become cursed by persons like him. And what's the way to do that? By becoming more mystically powerful than Bhrigu Muni or anyone else like that. So Hiranyakashipu is the epitome of what we call today high self-esteem. Instead of calling it false ego, it's now called self-esteem. And you are made to believe that your ineffectiveness in material acquisition and advancement is due to not enough self-esteem. Hiranyakashipu had no self-esteem problems. He was convinced that the more power he gets, the more happy he'll be. And if his power is unchallenged, if his power cannot be contested in any way, then he has attained the ultimate. We described some days ago how we have this psychological tendency to put Hiranyakashipu in a class by himself, far away from us, because we're just innocent materialists. We have innocent material desires, or we're mixed. We have some desires to serve Krishna, and we want some things for ourselves. So that's to be expected. That's excusable. That's to be understood. We take that for granted. But let's once again look at the raw Hiranyakashipu principle and see how it could be present in our life. One Western philosopher said that happiness means, now let's see if we can identify with this in honesty. Happiness means when your power is increasing and all obstacles are overcome. That is happiness. So just think about that in your own life. My power is increasing and any obstacles around me are overcome. Then life is good. Things are going my way. Now, you might say, you don't want power. You want happiness. But you see, as soon as you endeavor for material happiness, it involves a power trip. You've got to utilize your senses and mind to shape situations around you. That's power. And there are always going to be impediments and obstacles. So you have to kind of maneuver your way around those obstacles and impediments. People don't behave the way you want them to behave. They don't reciprocate with you the way you want them to reciprocate. Nature doesn't cooperate with you. It doesn't provide for you unlimited resources, as the world is finding out now. Nature doesn't provide unlimited resources, nor does it provide unlimited space for you to dispose of the waste after you exploit the resources. So this presents a problem for happiness, as ordinarily conceived, because this is a problem about you're not being able to overcome obstacles in the way of your power. So if you start thinking power equals happiness, and you take away the innocent veil over it all, it's just me and my little desires, that's all. I just want a little bit. You take away that veil of false innocence and see what Krishna says in Bhagavad Gita, that ichchadvesha sumuttena dvandva mohena bharata. We're born in material existence, overcome by the dualities of desire and aversion. This is our psychology, the psychology of the Jivatma, the conditioned soul. What is it that we desire? We desire to imitate Krishna's enjoyment. And what is it that we are repulsed by? What is it that we revile? We revile Krishna's instructions. This is the problem at the core of our conditioned life. We want to either partially accept Krishna's instructions or not at all, but to take everything as it is, full on. This seems very intimidating to us. Where am I going to get my power? What about the obstacles of material life that get in the way of my happiness? Isn't Krishna concerned with that? We discussed this before. So Hiranyakashipu, he had no hang-ups whatsoever. He's going full on for material power, control, and enjoyment. He even understands that he's spirit soul, but that understanding that he's spirit soul does not at all diminish his thirst for material enjoyment. Okay, we're spirit soul, we're not the body, but in any case, let's enjoy the body. It's hard to figure out. You also read in the 10th canto how Kamsa, he could lecture, just like Hiranyakashipu, about how you're not the body. Both Kamsa and Hiranyakashipu could give classes on Atmatattva, the science of the spirit soul, and very brilliant classes. But their bottom line was, okay, we're spirit soul, so what? We're still going to enjoy the body. This is Asarika Bhava, the bhava, the emotional intensity of an asura. So what that the soul changes from one body to another? Enjoy each body that the soul gets while you can. Increase your power. Overcome obstacles. That's what life is all about. And in Hiranyakashipu's case, he knew Vishnu is the obstacle. I've always got to watch out because he killed my brother. So even though Hiranyakashipu is enjoying material life to the max, he cannot forget his envy of Vishnu. That shows you, no matter how much you get in terms of power, enjoyment, and control, there's always going to be dissatisfaction. You might say, look, get over it, Hiranyakashipu. You've got control over the whole universe. You're enjoying in the famous Nandanandana gardens. You're living in the palace of Indra. Just relax, enjoy. That's probably how we would take it. Just relax, enjoy. Go with what you have. You got everything. But that's not the way that Maya works. An essential component of material happiness is dissatisfaction. When will we ever get this through our head? It's not possible to have, quote-unquote, pure material happiness. Material happiness is always mixed with distress. Even on the heavenly planets, you're seeing that there's problems. Indra's palace is taken over. The enjoyment gardens of the demigods have been taken over by demons. So that's teaching us that nowhere in the material world will we find lasting peace and prosperity. So quickly, chaos can descend upon us. Catastrophes can descend upon us. I'll give you an example that sometimes I give in preaching engagements for those who remember a little bit of world history. How did World War II start? Hitler, everyone recognizes as a demon, he first annexed Austria, Czechoslovakia. His mentality was, the German people just need a little elbow room, that's all. We just need a little space to spread out a bit. We need to just gobble up a few countries around our country just for some breathing room, you know. Innocent. See, this is the materialistic mentality. What I want is just not a big deal. You know, innocent. I don't want much. You could just imagine Hitler saying, I'm not Hiranyakashipu wanting to control the whole universe. I just want a, what's the German word? Lebensraum. Just a little living room, you know, a little move elbows around, you know, that's what I need for the people. I'm doing this for the people. So he gobbled up Austria, Czechoslovakia, the Allies. They didn't do anything. You know, two big countries, who cares about them anyway, you know. Then he made a deal with the other demon, Stalin, that we're going to divide Poland and we'll take it over. You take over the east, we'll take over the western side. So he did that. He roared into Poland. And then he was shocked. England and France declared war because they were allied with Poland. They declared war on Germany. And Hitler knew Germany's not ready for war. He understood that. He had figured out that the USA wouldn't interfere. He said, the USA is way across the ocean, and they don't have the racial purity of the Aryans to be effective. But then these European powers declared war. And he actually, this is a historical fact, he didn't know what to do. He turned to his foreign minister and said, what now? What do we do now? 4 years later, 50 million people are dead. Just off of, what now? This is the way it works. And we think it's all rational and it's all, everything happens smoothly and we have our United Nations, we have our president, other countries have their prime ministers and they have their political organizations, the EU, and it's all rational and somehow they're all going to sort it out. This is a classic example that I always bring up from a, what do we do now? I didn't expect this. 4 years later, 50 million people dead. This is the way the kingdom of Maya works. So Hiranyakashipu has taken over the palace of Indra. He thinks he's got real wealth. But actually, what is the wealth even of the heavenly planets compared to the wealth of Vaikuntha? You get the ability to make a comparison by reading Bhagavatam and Chaitanya Charitamrita. You read that the beautiful ladies of the earthly planet are nothing compared to the heavenly fragrant ladies of the heavenly planets. But those heavenly fragrant ladies of the celestial realm are nothing compared to the Lakshmis of Vaikuntha in the spiritual world. And those Lakshmis of Vaikuntha cannot compare to Krishna's cowherd girls in Vrindavan and the favors they enjoyed from Krishna. So you get to see the whole scale, and then you can make your aspirations appropriately. In Vrindavan, Krishna as a little child would not reveal his powers. He wanted everyone to understand that he is their beloved son, their beloved friend, their lover. So he did not reveal his powers except in such a way that everyone would completely forget about it. So his mother would ask him, please bring your father's wooden shoes. Now, Krishna is just a little child. Lifting wooden shoes is a task for such a little child. But Krishna would do that. And then Vishnachakri Thakur says that the mother would give him requests for increasingly heavier items. And Krishna would try to bring wooden planks. He would try to bring wooden pots. And finally, if he decided that he couldn't lift those things, he would just move his arms like that, showing, I do have strength. I do have strength, even though I can't lift this. I've got muscles. Of course, Krishna can lift anything. Everything is his energy. But he wanted to give that pleasure to those who love him in Vatsalya Prem, his mother Yashoda and the other elderly gopi ladies of Vrindavan. Sometimes these elderly gopi ladies, they would clap their hands and make music and encourage Krishna, dance, 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 like they were puppet masters. And Krishna would do that. And sometimes they would encourage Krishna, you sing, you sing. And he would, the little child would just start singing loudly at the request of his devotees. Why is Krishna doing this? He wants to establish what is real wealth. He's showing, Britya Vashyata, the real wealth, the topmost wealth, is that I come under the control of my servants. I want to do that. And so I'm demonstrating that in Braj Leela. I'm demonstrating what is the greatest opulence. The greatest opulence is even beyond my own Aishwarya, my own opulence of wealth and power and majesty. The real opulence is attracted by the love of my devotees. I agree to become under their control. So in the 10th canto, it's described how one day, while Krishna was a child, one poor native woman of the outer precincts of Braj, she came to the village to sell fruit. And she had her baskets full of fruit. And Krishna decided as a little boy to imitate what he saw the elders do, that they would barter. They would exchange some grains for whatever the vendor was selling. So Krishna scooped up some grains in his little hand, and he went towards the lady to give her the grains in exchange for the fruit. But as you remember, every step he took toward her, the grains were falling out of his little hand. And so by the time he got to the fruit vendor, he didn't have it, but just one or two grains in his hand. But what was the fruit vendor thinking? She's thinking, oh, what a beautiful sight. She was overwhelmed with affection. Just see little Krishna. He's coming toward me with grains to give in exchange for the fruit. And the grains are practically all fell out of his hand. What a sight. What beauty. She wasn't thinking that Krishna is the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Here's my chance to cash in. What unfulfilled desires do I have? It's about time. No, she's a resident of Vrindavan. She doesn't think like that. She's just overwhelmed by this sweet scene of little Krishna carrying grains and apparently being very ineffective and clumsy about it. But the clumsiness was the height of beauty. It was unlimitedly beautiful, the scene. And so she became so absorbed in seeing this. So what did she do? Without any concern for her own prosperity, without any concern for her bottom line, she took all the fruits she had and she just loaded them in Krishna's hands. Like, never mind that you don't have enough grains to exchange with me. Never mind. You take all the fruits I can give you. Now, of course, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur, he's the acharya of transcendental details of the Leelas. He said, how was he able to accommodate all the fruits that she was giving him? He expanded his Aishwarya Shakti. He expanded his energy of majestic power and wealth. And that way he could hold all the fruits that she was giving him. Although ordinarily, according to his age and his body size, that wasn't to be. You see, in Krishna Leela, the Lord generally does not act out of harmony with his apparent age or size, because that would disturb the sweetness of the Leela. And when that does happen occasionally, Yogamaya quickly covers over the scene so that the residents of Vrindavan, they don't think about a majestic, powerful display that Krishna has done, like when he knocked down the Yamalarjun trees. What happened was explained away. Mother Yasoda says, actually, the Yamalarjun trees came down because of a strong wind. And Govardhan Hill was actually lifted by Nanda Maharaj. So Yogamaya quickly covers Krishna's Aishwarya tracks. That didn't happen. Or if it did happen, it was because of some other reason. Narayan appeared through Krishna and did it all. Or Krishna's a demigod. Therefore, he can do amazing things. This is the cowherd boy's conclusion. After Krishna swallowed the forest fire, in the Munja forest, the forest fire was gone, they were safe, and they began to consider. Krishna told us to close our eyes. So we did, because, you know, we do whatever Krishna says. Not because he's God, they don't do that, but because he's their, the friend of the friend of the friend. He's the best friend you can have. How could we not do what our best friend says? He said, close our eyes, and there's a forest fire all around. Would you do that? You're encircled by a forest fire. It's about to devour you. You know, you have these, what do you call these fires? It's, huh? No, in Southern California. No, you have wildfires. Yes, in Australia they call them bushfires. So I said the right word. You have these wildfires. And so someone come, a little boy comes up to you and says, just close your eyes. Meanwhile, the flames are all around you. Would you do it? No, that's why you're not in Krishna Lila. You say, hey, I'm keeping my eyes open. Where's the fire department? But Krishna just said, close your eyes. And they did that. Not only was the forest fire swallowed by Krishna, but when the cowherd boys opened their eyes, they were safe under a tree where they always would take prasad. The Krishna had transported them to a safe place of their pastimes. So the cowherd boys began to discuss, our friend Krishna, what kind of little boy is this? And then they came up with a brilliant solution. Krishna is a demigod. That's why he could swallow the forest fire. So then what follows from that? If Krishna is a demigod, so are we. We're all demigods too, because we're just as good as him. Brilliant deduction. Makes complete sense in Vrindavan. He's a demigod. We're also demigods because we're all equal. This is Sakyaras. We're friends. He's our peer. So this is how life in Vrindavan goes on. So the fruit vendor, she became overwhelmed by the beauty of Krishna giving her practically nothing in return for her fruits. And she gave away all her fruits. And then it turned out that her basket was full of gems. Now you might say, okay, this is bhakti. Yeah, there's the Vrindavan rasa, and then there's real things, wealth, gems. Her whole basket was full of gems. She hit the jackpot. She won the lottery. This is Krishna at his best. He's giving Braj flavor, and he's giving material wealth too. Of course, in Vrindavan, actually, all the wealth is spiritual. The ground is Chintamani, touchstone. But this native poor woman wasn't thinking like that. Although her basket was full of gems, she's not thinking, oh, now I'm rich. Because simultaneously with Krishna putting gems in her basket, the acharyas explain he gave her Krishna Prem. And what does Krishna Prem mean? It means simply love of Krishna for Krishna's benefit. That's all. Now let's consider Hiranyakashipu and Kamsa. Kamsa was totally hung up about Krishna. The eighth child of Devaki was going to kill him. This is what he thought about day and night, day and night. This was actually a Krishna conscious absorption, although it was unfavorable. The eighth child of Devaki will kill me. I must kill that child first, although that child can't be killed. He was going crazy like this. I've got to kill a child who can't be killed. I've got to strike first and kill a child, even though the child will kill me. But I've got to kill a child that can't be killed. So he was just going nuts day and night. It's like a computer that's locked up, you know. So after Vasudev did his thing, taking newborn Krishna to Vrindavan and coming back to the prison, and the prison doors closed behind him, and Vasudev chained himself in again. The sound of the newborn child filled the prison, and Kamsa's guards come running to him. The child's born! The child's born! Kamsa was waiting. He didn't hesitate to take answer. He jumped up, said, Kaloyam! Time has come. In other words, he understood time is death. Time is Krishna's energy, his Kala Shakti, for killing. We think of time in a very innocent way. Oh, time is passing, another day, another night. But actually, it's an energy that diminishes matter. It kills bodies. That's why in the 12th canto of Bhagavatam, Shukadeva Goswami explains, Kalena Balina Rajan, O King, Pritchett Maharaj, Kali Yuga is an expression of time diminishing all the good qualities of human beings. By that force of time, all the good qualities of human beings are finished. So Kamsa understood this. Kaloyam, time has come to finish me. Or you can look at it another way, according to the Acharyas. Time, death has come for that eighth child. I'm going to kill that child. So he raced into the prison room, and he got on his knees. He was a big, huge brute. And he, on his knees, he grabbed the newborn child by the legs to smash the child's head against the prison wall. It was a horrible act. And just see Devaki, she knows her child is safe, but she's going to plead on behalf of someone else's child. This is Vaishnavism, always concerned for the others. She put her heart and soul into saving someone else's child, and she knew her own child was safe. So you know how Kamsa's attempt to kill the daughter failed because that daughter flew up in the air and revealed her form as Durga Devi. At which point, Kamsa became overwhelmed with awe and reverence. Oh my goodness, Devaki, I thought she was an ordinary human being, but she has given birth to Durga, the source of all material power and opulence. Wow, I never knew her full glories. So he began to beg forgiveness. Please, you know, it was all by karma that your seven children were killed. You know, I was actually not the doer. we are not responsible for our activities. There's an overall system of control, and I know I've acted hideously and abominably, killing your children, but please forgive me. And he actually fell at their feet, fell at the feet of Vasudeva and Devaki. I beg forgiveness. Now, it's interesting. You may wonder about that appeal by Kamsa. He was, first of all, overwhelmed by having seen Durga Devi, you know, the source of all material power. And secondly, Prabhupada writes in the purport that by the grace of the Lord, he was able to have some realizations. And so he was speaking like that from the heart. And also, Srila Prabhupada writes that in this part of Krishna Leela, the prison cell scene, the activities of Yoga Maya are distinctly at work. So Krishna's pastime managing energy is arranging these things for his satisfaction. So Kamsa, for all those reasons, he was actually regretting. And he was, the whole scene was being manipulated by Yoga Maya. He made such an extraordinary apology, speaking knowledge of the self, Atma-tattva, just like Hiranyakashipu did to his relatives when Hiranyaksha was slain. So what was Devaki's reaction? Yes, you are speaking rightly. There is the immediate cause, and then there's the remote cause. So they actually forgave Kamsa, she and her husband. Now just think, you're a mother or father with seven children that have been slaughtered by this brute. And he's going to speak these words, and you're going to forgive him completely? They actually forgave him. They gave up their anger. You're saying, how does that happen? Well, first of all, Yoga Maya is at work. But secondly, Vasudeva and Devaki, they're Kshatriyas. She's the wife of a Kshatriya. So they're practical. yeah, we'll accept your forgiveness, because, anyway, you're going to die, so. The eighth child has been safely born, so, sure, we'll forgive you. They're a bit pragmatic, you know, real politic. Yeah, why not? We'll give up our anger. You're a dead man. You'll get yours. So they sincerely forgave Kamsa. So it doesn't end there. What happened? Although Kamsa sincerely regretted and fell at their feet, that night he gathered his assembled demons around him and told them, you know, Durgadevi said that the eighth child was born somewhere else. And so, hey, what can you do? I guess that's that, you know. I guess, we, you know, well, who knows? We'll just leave it at that. But the fellow demons said, no way. We've got to be proactive. We've got to kill all the children in the vicinity. And they told Kamsa that, you know, the demigods are always afraid of you, without a doubt. They run away from you in battle. They cry out for mercy every time you fight them. They're spineless. You are the greatest. You are the power. And they can't handle that. And we all know there's actually no need to fear them because they're so weak in front of you. Nevertheless, these are special emergency circumstances. So we have to have a war on terror because of the emergency circumstances. They said that. We can't act according to normal Vedic codes for fighting. We've got to suspend all that, executive order. And and we just got to kill randomly, do whatever it takes to get rid of this threat. Just like you deal with debt, you deal with fire, we've got to deal with the possibility of this eighth child being somewhere else. So what's the way to go? Destroy anything that has to do with higher human qualities and God consciousness. That way you actually get at Vishnu. They had it all figured out. You see, you have to destroy the traditional foundations of happiness in society, because those traditional foundations of happiness involve sense control, austerity, mercy, and especially protecting cows and brahmanas, Vedic knowledge, yajna. We've got to get rid of all that. And that's the way you get rid of Vishnu and the demigods, by attacking the culture, by attacking the social dynamics that bring about a progressive society. And so that's what they went about doing. And you see, this demoniac program goes on and on and on. That's what a materialist thinks. Destroy everyone's self-control and discipline. Turn them into consumers. You capture the market, and then everything is wonderful. And we're seeing the results of that kind of mentality today. Change the whole world into a global market. Get everyone to wear the same clothes, eat the same food, and then, because of economy of mass, because you have a global market of everyone wanting the same product, you can produce very cheaply and you make a huge profit. So we make the whole world into a global marketplace. Everyone is consuming the same things. You can produce in mass quantity, and that way your costs, your production costs go way down due to the mass scale, and you've got so much money, and there'll be peace and lasting prosperity. This is the way it's going on today. So you'll see all these principles recited by the followers of Kamsa, and he listened to them. Finally, we spoke a few days ago about how persons become terrorist bombers, or how they are motivated and manipulated to do things they normally wouldn't do. Well, Kamsa got totally manipulated, even though he had sincerely regretted. And it's his fault, because he kept the association that he did. You can't say, oh, he was innocent, he sincerely regretted, and then these demons, they carried him off in another direction. What's he doing associating with them? So Bhagavad Dharma, the bhakti science, always analyzes, what's your association? You get the blame for the company you keep. That's a lesson that we can learn. If we keep the association of devotees, we'll be always fascinated and attracted by the true opulence of Krishna in Vrindavan, in which he comes under the control of his devotees' love. The true wealth that the fruit vendor got was not jewels. The true wealth was Krishna Prem, pure love of Krishna. And Krishna's letting that be known, that I'm conquered by pure love. I didn't have anything to give her in return except pure love. I didn't have any grains. They all fell out of my hand. But I gave her Krishna Prem. All right, we'll stop here. Any questions? Yes.
How can we disassociate from the spirit?
How can we, what's that? Oh, you're waiting for the microphone.
So in order for us not to participate of the consumption that these materialistic people have, those tendencies of being very demoniac, and in the consumption, we as devotees, we need a lot of things from them, apparently we need. And then we Krishnaize things, thinking, well, it's for Krishna, but actually, in another sense, we are consuming from them many things that we could probably do in our own way without having to participate. So how can we disassociate? Can you talk about it?
We recognize that everything belongs to Krishna, and it's our obligation to use everything of this world in Krishna's service. So that means if it's used in Krishna's service, it's not used in our service. So we always have to be very careful about that. Just like I was crossing the street this morning, and I don't know, for the first time, the beauty of the doors struck me in the morning light. And so, you know, that's opulence. It's wood. There's, I don't know, what is it, brass or something like that. But it's used for the pleasure of Shishi Rukmini Dwarkadish. So we're not, we don't have phobias about using the things of this world for Krishna's pleasure. Our phobia is a legitimate one, to make sure indeed it's for Krishna's pleasure. So we're always checking ourselves out. Am I actually getting something or acquiring something for Krishna's pleasure, or is it for my own satisfaction? And that mentality purifies us. You're in the city here. What are cities about? They're not about, you know, self-sufficiency. You're in the middle of the city, Los Angeles, 12 million people. So your purpose here is to preach, to attract others to bhakti. Otherwise, there's no point in being here. If one doesn't want to preach, there's no point in being in the city. Of course, we have yet to establish alternative situations for those who actually want to live simply in rural areas. That's a tough one, because until there's necessity, you're not going to see people want to live simply and grow food. It's happening now in Greece because of the economic crash. So many young people are saying, let's go and farm. But that's not because of romanticism. Guess why? Why they're thinking like that? Yeah, they're forced to. Farming looks good, they say. This is a great occupation. They don't have any other choice. So it'll probably be like that for devotees in the first world. They won't think about seriously executing living in the country, countryside, growing food until they're forced. But meanwhile, we're in the city. And we should not live in the city just because of economic convenience. We should live in the city to preach and assist the preaching. All right. Yes, Prabhu.
Arj, thank you for your wonderful and eloquent class. You had mentioned how our attachment to low-class enjoyment is based on ignorance, which is in turn based on sinful activities. And my question is, how are we, how can we hope to have success in our preaching activities when people are so attached to their sinful activities?
well, look at us, we're here. Something must have worked. We've been here, some of the devotees in this room have been here four decades or more. So something must be happening. This is Lord Chaitanya's mercy. We're representing Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, who makes the impossible possible. And the more we participate, one way or another, in outreach activities, the more you'll see that miracle in action. So therefore, it's essential for followers of Lord Chaitanya to somehow or other take part in outreach activities. Monthly Sankirtan festival, bhakti house, this, that, somehow or other. And New Dwarka is full of opportunities if someone sincerely wants to plug in to outreach activities, assisting them. There's so many opportunities. And then we'll see the miracle in action. We'll always be in touch with that miracle. All right. Thank you very much. Hare Krishna.